there's been a certain level of schizophrenia in the foreign policy of this country when dealing with Iraq for the last 12 or 13 years.
Public broadcasting shouldn't be taking any ads at all, period. In fact, that's the whole point of public broadcasting.
This is the broadest, deepest anti-war sentiment and movement before a war starts in the United States history.
Working and poor people in this country have more in common with the people of Iraq than they do with the people in power in this country right now.
Say no to death and war and yes to life, so that we may be made worthy of the long-promised blessing reserved for the peacemakers.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, January 16th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Weapons Inspection Chief Hans Blix is expected to schedule a second report back to the Security Council, possibly in mid-March. Blix announced at a press conference last week that his first report on January 27th will only be a progress report on the work of the inspectors. He said that it would likely take as long as a year before the team could verify whether Iraq still possesses weapons of mass destruction and if it presents a threat to the rest of the world. Meanwhile, the Bush administration presses ahead with its plans for war, stating that time is running out for Iraq to disarm. Speaking with Peace Watch author William Rivers Pitt, who says the apparent rush towards war on the part of the United States and the dismissal of diplomatic solutions is cause for concern.
It just sort of goes to show, to my way of thinking, the priorities here. They're not terribly interested in solving the weapons of mass destruction issue without engaging in a fairly ruinous war. And the fact that they are trying to disrupt the timetable of the inspectors seems to be proof positive of this. And it's very unfortunate and it's very dangerous.
And in fact, the Bush administration is also stating now that it may decide to engage in military action even if the inspectors do not turn up any evidence, and it hasn't committed to seeking final approval for such action from the Security Council.
That's a fairly old tune. That's been going since about September, October. I have in the back of my head that that is a tool of diplomatic pressure, both on the Iraqis and on the Security Council. And I'm hoping that they don't mean what they say on that, because that's the nightmare scenario. That's the worst possible thing that could happen.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. demanded for months that the weapons inspectors be permitted to return to Iraq, but now that they've returned and haven't found any hard evidence of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, it appears as though the U.S. is turning back to the 12,000-page dossier that Iraq submitted to the United Nations, citing Iraq's alleged omissions from that document as a justification to go to war.
Well, this is the same administration that claims Donald Rumsfeld, who, in the run-up to this thing, months before it went before NATO to discuss Iraq, and this is early, and when they asked him why there was no evidence specifically pointing to a weapons program and the evidence of these weapons in Iraq, Mr. Rumsfeld said, and I quote, "The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence," basically expecting the Iraqi regime to prove a negative. They've set up a really wonderful catch-22. There's a lot of people will tell you, and I'm one of them, that the Bush administration's supposed incontrovertible proof that Iraq has these weapons that they've bandied about for so long and refused to show anybody is in large part the bill of lading, the manifests for all the stuff that we shipped over to them in the 80s. Most of that, I think all of that, was pretty much destroyed during the war, during the first ONSCOM inspectors, and the rest of it has gone up in smoke because the stuff that we gave them degrades after a few years. It just strikes me, going after the report the way that they have, that they are grasping at straws, and the international community, I don't think, is going to be fooled by this. The entire world is going to get a lesson in a very, very active and invigorated diplomacy pretty soon. And I think the Bush administration is going to be at the butt end of that lesson. There are countries and governments that have been playing this game a lot longer than the Bushies, and nobody is interested in playing by their rules.
Well, at the same time, however, they're building up troops in the region. 150,000 U.S. troops are amassing in the region, so they seem to be moving forward in a pretty confident manner. In addition to that, they've accelerated the amount of raids or bombs in the so-called no-fly zone.
Mm-hmm. No, they're making every move like they mean it. They would probably tell you that again. This is a negotiating tactic to let the Iraqi regime know that they're serious. It's a fairly expensive and dangerous tactic to take. I don't think that anything is inevitable. I don't think that we are headed for an inevitable confrontation. I think that the Security Council is going to have a lot of say. And I think that if the Bush administration goes to war without the United Nations and without the international community on their side, we are in for a very long, dark period of time in this country.
Well, are they likely to do that? I mean, we saw earlier this week where support among the allies seems to be dwindling a bit.
In England in particular, one of the interesting differences between our government and the British government is that, you know, essentially if you win the presidency in America, you get to kind of be king for 4 years. The only way they can remove you is by impeachment. You can be thwarted, you can be blocked. You know, if you have a Congress that's against you, a lot of your stuff can get thrown out the window, but you're going to be there for 4 years. In Britain, their government is held together by coalitions,
mm-hmm.
and if parliamentary coalitions, and if that parliamentary coalition that holds the majority that controls the government falls apart, the prime minister is in a pretty high, cold, lonely, and windy place.
Mm-hmm. But it seems as though British Prime Minister Tony Blair has been in a pretty high, cold, lonely place for some time. Much of the media has characterized him as Bush's poodle, and yet the Britain, the formal position, is squarely behind the U.S.
For the time being, the rising anti-war sentiment in Britain is going to start really putting a lot of pressure on them. And then you look at Germany, which is another parliamentary government. The only reason why Schröder's majority holds together is because of the German Green Party. That's his linchpin. He, you know, the Social Democrats and the German Green Party are a coalition government, and the German Green Party will bolt if Schröder starts making noises that approve heartily of the Bush administration's plans here. So there's going to be a lot of European domestic politics that go into what's going to happen with this thing, and it's all going to be very interesting to watch.
Yes, that Germany factor will be particularly interesting, given the fact that Germany will be taking over the chairmanship.
Absolutely.
Of the UN Security Council, what, in about 3 weeks or so?
Yep, absolutely.
And
that changes the geometry pretty significantly.
It's been suggested that some sort of a commitment was made between Germany and the U.S. prior to this.
Schröder could have told the Bush administration a whole bunch of things, but his government will fall if the coalition that is supporting him splinters. The same thing will happen to Tony Blair. Right now, they're holding it together, but if push comes to shove, he's going to lose a lot of his support, and all of a sudden, we're going to have divided governments all across Europe.
What if reliable evidence of weapons of mass destruction was produced? Would that, in your opinion, be justification to go to war, or do you have a problem with the notion of preemption on the part of the United States?
Well, I have a problem with preemption in general, but by the same token, I don't necessarily believe that if Iraq is shown to have these weapons of mass destruction, the international community forbade them to have them years ago, spent a lot of money and a lot of time to make sure that they didn't have them. If they still have them, we're, I think, to a certain degree, out of the realm of preemption and back into the realm of defiance of the UN Security Council, defiance of the international community, which is a slightly different breed of cat. I think that if reliable evidence for these weapons is discovered, I think immediately the Security Council needs to, you know, sit around that table and decide what to do and decide whether war or a vigorous inspection regime to take everything apart over there is the answer.
Well, I thought that was the idea, to disarm them.
Yes, the idea is to disarm them. But the idea has also always been, even during the Clinton administration, to get rid of Saddam Hussein. One of the central reasons why the ONSCOM inspection regime fell apart in 1998 was because the inspectors were getting close to declaring Iraq totally disarmed, and Madeleine Albright got up in front of a room full of reporters and told them that even if the inspectors declare Iraq to be 100% free of weapons of mass destruction, we're not going to lift the sanctions because we're going to keep the sanctions on until Saddam Hussein is gone, just sort of changing the rules at the end of the game. That rule has been in place since the first Bush administration, when in the process of the run-up to the war, it became less about Iraq getting out of Kuwait and more about getting Saddam Hussein out of office,
mm-hmm.
Which is curious because they then, at the conclusion of the war, The American military forces over there did a number of things to make sure that Saddam Hussein stayed in power. So there's been a certain level of schizophrenia in the foreign policy of this country when dealing with Iraq for the last 12 or 13 years.
William Rivers Pitt is the co-author with former Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter of War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. A delegation of four women who suffered personal losses on September 11th recently traveled to what could become the second ground zero as part of the group, September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Delegation member Terry Rockefeller found that Iraqis are equally proud of their nation and history and even fractured friendships they once held with the United States. Peace Watch producer Robert Knight was there as Rockefeller recalled her journey.
People in Iraq have an extraordinary knowledge of their history. And by that I mean their recent history. I mean, they can tell you exactly the years that Iraq and America were allies and what that meant to them. They remember the dates of key battles. I mean, in a way that it was just very impressive. But one aspect of that is also their pride in their 5,000-year history and being the cradle of civilization. And with it came a profound sense of their real national identity. And what they would say was, we are not going to accept subjugation by anyone. And I can just report that that was spoken to us over and over and over again.
Colleen Kelly says she discovered in Baghdad that the work of Peaceful Tomorrows, of enacting peace through international friendship, is shared by others who also hope to avert a war in Iraq.
We met this group, the Bereaved Parents Circle, last March, and talk about an inspiration. This was a group, as I mentioned before, of parents who are both Palestinian and Israeli who have all lost loved ones to Middle East violence. And September 11th, happened for one day here, and violence in the Middle East happens daily, if not weekly. And that group, it was started by a gentleman named Yitzhak Frankenthal, and they have almost 300 members. When I saw them, there was a Palestinian father who had lost his son 17 days prior and was traveling with this group to the United States. So their witness and their example was tremendously helpful to us as a group because they continue to live with the violence and the terrorism so close to them and continue to refute the notion that more violence is going to end all this. And they're incredibly powerful. So that's one very concrete, powerful example that still continues in my mind in their work. Another thing that happened last April was atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki came to the United States to express their condolences to family members. And the original ground zero is really at Hiroshima. But they came to our ground zero here in the States. And that was also another very powerful witness. And they came, most are very elderly in their 70s. They came because they felt that the world wasn't really remembering what atomic warfare is like, that we had grown so far apart from that, that they wanted to use themselves as living examples of what atomic warfare really does to people. And hearing their stories of that day in August in 1945 was another very, very powerful example. And this was 57 years ago, and they're still talking and going around the world and talking about their experience and warning us all.
Colleen Kelly, whose brother was killed in the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, along with three members of the Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. She recently participated in a peace delegation to Iraq, thanks to Robert Knight from Pacifica Station WBAI for preparing that segment.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your home. holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand?
Sarah Thompson, Is It for Freedom? Turkey issued an invitation today to five Arab countries to attend a meeting to discuss peaceful ways to defuse the Iraq crisis. Meanwhile, the latest voices of protest in Turkey to raise concerns about the proposed war that comes from laborers and trade unionists. Aaron Glantz reports from the Turkish capital, Ankara.
Amerikan askeri olmayacağız. Amerikan askeri olmayacağız.
The president of Turkey's public sector workers union, Sami Evratan, stands before a chanting crowd of more than 1,000 trade unionists at lunch hour in downtown Ankara, the Turkish capital. The workers chant, "Killer U.S. out of Middle East, America should remember Vietnam, and American people, go from our country."
This war will cause many innocent civilians to die in Iraq. More than 560,000 Iraqi children are already dead because of the sanctions. The last time the U.S. bombed Iraq, they used depleted uranium, and because of this, the cancer rate increased.
Abdullah Anar is a member of Turkey's Mechanical Engineers Union. He is one of the dozens of engineers who turned out for today's demonstration.
It's not America's job. Otherwise, we can come and ask to America to change George Bush, because we don't like him. We know he's the biggest terrorist on the world. But we don't say anything to USA people, because they elected him.
Anti-war demonstrations have become more frequent in Turkey in recent weeks. Every day, at least 1,000 turn out on the streets of Ankara or Istanbul, with up to 10,000 turning out on the weekend. The cause of the stepped-up mobilization is the increasing pressure the United States is putting on the government here to use Turkish military bases to stage a massive 80,000-troop northern invasion of Iraq to complement a southern invasion to be launched from Saudi Arabia or U.S. Central Command in Qatar. The Turkish government has angered the Bush administration by refusing to support such a move until after the weapons inspectors deliver their preliminary report to the U.N. Security Council. Erkam Suner is president of the Ankara branch of the Medical Workers Union. He is not optimistic.
The government seems like it is not supporting this war, but it has already sent Turkish soldiers into northern Iraq. They will join this war, at least by opening military bases and harbors to the U.S. military. They showed this. 150 people came from the USA, and they showed these images. They are pretending. They are saying they are against the war, but on the other hand, they are doing some other things.
Turkish officials protest Sooner's analysis, saying no decisions have yet been made. A Turkish foreign ministry spokesperson told reporters in Ankara that Turkey's agreement to allow U.S. military teams to inspect Turkish bases and ports did not mean the government had given the U.S. permission to station troops at those bases. Khatma Yol is an activist in Turkey's office workers union. She notes Turkey's new government is run by the Islamic AK Party. It's not just leftists who oppose the war, she says.
This government will be against the war because they are Islamic, and to please their Islamic base, They must be against the war. Big business can easily be convinced to make war, but it's not easy to convince the small businesses to make war. There are lots of small businesses who think that war will hurt their businesses, and this government is supported by them. This is why the position against war is very important for the government to listen to.
Turkish Prime Minister Abdullah Gül says he will present a peace plan to the world January 27th. It will be the result of 2 weeks of shuttling between Turkey, Syria, Egypt, and Jordan. Turkey's trade minister has just returned from a visit to Baghdad. 300 Turkish businessmen came with him. This week, U.S. officials acknowledged a war with only a southern attack could prove long and bloody. Again, activist Hatma Diol.
Yani başka destekçiler bulmaya çalışır ama bu durumda işi çok zor olacaktır. Şu ana kadar beklemesi, yani demek ki çok büyük bir stratejik anlamda önemli bir yer ki şu ana kadar savaş ya, niyeti çoktan başlatmıştır. Çünkü Amerikan da işine gelmiyor. Süreci uzatırsa kendi lehine dönüyor, aleyhine dönüyor her şey. Bu süreci kendi iradesi dışında bence bizim de işte 26'sını ya da 28'i Birleşmiş Milletler kararını beklememizin de bunda bir etki şeyi var. Bu nedenle son zamanlardaki ataklarını da daha da geliştirdi. Bence biz bu savaşa girmeyi çok şey yapmaz.
Fatih, ABD, Orta Doğu'da NATO.
There's a protest at the American Embassy here tomorrow.
Barış hemen şimdi, savaşa hayır.
Just now.
Barış hemen şimdi.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
Local labor union officials, staff, and activists from across America met last week in Chicago to express their growing opposition to the Bush administration's push for war in Iraq. The meeting was hosted by Teamster Local 705, the second largest Teamster local in the nation. Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg spoke with Bob Muhlenkamp, former executive vice president of Local 1199, currently organizing campaigns with various unions, and Paul Werhouse, administrative assistant to the secretary-treasurer, Teamster Local 705 in Chicago. Muhlenkamp commented on the strength and impact of the peace movement in the USA and around the world.
The anti-war movement in this country and around the world has already decisively influenced the Bush policy. They did not want to go to the UN. They had to go to the UN. They did not want a resolution. They got one. They didn't want the resolution. They got. They did not want the inspections to drag on as much as they have. They don't like the results of the inspections. They don't have to live by the inspections. Their only ally in the world is Britain, outside of Kuwait. They are saying now that we have to come back for a second vote and allow more time. So, in fact, world public opinion and United States public opinion, which is not fully mobilized and organized, but which exists, has already had a severe influence over what they would like to do. And now, as far as the labor movement goes, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that this is the broadest and deepest anti-war sentiment and movement before a war starts in United States history. I think what's going on is extraordinary. In October, the president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, issued a letter to members of Congress raising very serious questions before their vote. Over 100 local unions and central labor councils have passed resolutions opposing the war. Saturday in Chicago at 7:05, we had a meeting. We had over 125 trade unionists there from literally all over the country, representing over 60 unions who deliberated, voted unanimously on a resolution, set up an organization, funded it in the room, raised over $30,000. Every local went back and committed to raise more money to fund an anti-war, national labor, anti-war organizations called, by the way, U.S. Labor Against War. And this has never happened before. So hopefully we can inform unions and union members quickly enough and well enough so that unions can join this anti-war movement and we can all be enough of an influence to stop it. They've now had to postpone well into February, so we have a couple of weeks of breathing room, and we have to build this to try to stop them from going in, even in late February.
Tell us some of the forces that were there in Chicago at that meeting.
There were a lot of Chicago unions there, obviously. The teachers union has passed a lot of resolutions all over the country. AFSCME, the international union, Service Employees International Union, the Hotel and Restaurant Workers, Unite, Steel Workers, Auto Workers, Teamsters.
Longshoremen workers.
There would seem to be a certain stereotype that blue-collar workers are less inclined to jump on the anti-war bandwagon. What has been your experience, Paul Waterhouse, given what Bob Mollenkamp has been saying? There seems to be tremendous enthusiasm against the war in the working class movement.
I think the fact that the members of our local passed an anti-war resolution as early as October 20th of just this last year pretty much gives lie to the thought that blue-collar workers do not oppose President Bush on this issue. I mean, we are the second largest Teamster local in the country. Certainly, it was very clear when the members were talking about this resolution, which passed almost unanimously, and they felt very strongly that it was like, whoa, wait a minute, what is this suddenly, this Iraq business about? There's never been any connection between Iraq and the events of 9/11. There's, I think, a very strong distrust of Bush and the Republican policies, and they see this as part of an extension of that. And so the feelings, I think, are very strong when you have that big of a margin of a vote in a blue-collar, huge local in Chicago. That's an indication, it seems to me, that there is a lot of distrust about this issue, and that Democrats and Republicans, elected officials, were way out in front of the voters on this issue, too, I think.
Paul, it seems as if Local 705 is in the middle of organizing in Chicago in terms of the anti-war activity. What's been going on in Chicago in terms of unions and the anti-war movement?
One of the things that we did shortly after that meeting was that a coalition of community groups asked Jerry Zero and Local 705 to host a community forum on what the impact of the war would be, and Jerry, in his conversations with other folks, had a number of unions that co-sponsored that gathering. And we have hotel and restaurant employees union here, Tom Balanoff, who is the president of Illinois Service Employees International Union, and an international vice president, was a principal spokesman at that. Needle Trades, Jerry's talked to other Teamster locals here in our joint council, and the warehouse workers local here, and the grocery drivers have sponsored various events. Jerry is going to be speaking in front of the city council on Wednesday on a city council anti-war resolution.
Bob Mollenkamp.
The polls of union members and the conversations we have all show that, I tell you the phrase that I hear the most among union people about this is that Bush has not made the case, that's how people talk, he has not made the case that Hussein is a threat to this country, that the UN inspection stuff doesn't work, they're not finding anything, and that we should start a war.
Bob, as we conclude this segment, what are the plans for U.S. labor against the war, and how can people contact the organization?
Well, they can go to a website, alternet.org/ USLAW, U.S. Labor Against War. That's really the best way. The immediate thing is that the resolution was passed, is being circulated all over the country with a goal of having 200 unions sign on to it before the 28th. And third, they can, if they're going to the demonstration in Washington, they can find out at that website the location where all the unions are gathering together so that the trade union movement marches in that demonstration together.
Bob Mollenkamp, former executive vice president of Local 1199. This report on the historic gathering within the labor movement was produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg of Building Bridges, your community and labor report, Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.